Can you tell, and Barb, you should do the same, can you tell the listener, Sam, remind them who Katya is?
Katya is our third of four children. She's currently 8 years old, born in 2001 with an underlying chromosomal syndrome called full trisomy 13.
Right.
Essentially means that she doesn't have a single normal cell in her body.
Okay.
You don't die from that condition, per se, if you have that generally. What becomes life-threatening or challenging medically or developmentally is the defects that causes to various systems and organs. So,
okay.
They call them midline defects, but really it could be anywhere.
Okay.
But midline would include brain, heart, and some other key organ areas.
All right.
In her case, there were a couple of initial salient medical issues that needed surgical intervention, but besides the GI one, the most significant one was the cardiac surgery. And why this came so much into play is that it's a highly valued and sought-after medical intervention for children, and they don't have unlimited resources. They can't do everyone's cardiac surgery in the world and have enough resources to do them necessarily. In Katya's case, they told us initially that we had the choice to pursue this life-saving intervention or not, and they couldn't recommend it because of some, what they described as quality of life issues. They referred to her as having a condition that is a lethal condition. We found these things to be untrue when we did further research, and so when we decided to accept the surgery, which had been initially offered to us as an option, all of a sudden it wasn't an option anymore.
Okay.
They were only fooling about us having a choice, and they had no intention of ever granting it, so we had to basically fight for her to get the cardiac surgery.
Okay.
And that resulted in a successful advocacy, and she became the first full trisomy 13 child in the country to get at least that kind of cardiac surgery. Barb, you heard something about
a child that was older than Katya had the surgery before a genetic diagnosis was made.
Oh, okay.
Which is interesting.
It is, because the child was, I believe, about maybe 1 or 2 years old, so the disability would have been manifested and evident. So it's interesting that one could deduce that she obtained the surgery, even though she had the disability, it wasn't a genetic disability.
Oh, okay.
Also, my understanding is this baby never went through a NICU.
That's right.
At the the primary tertiary center for care of neonates in Ontario, which is the hospital for sick children in Toronto. Katya did go through the NICU at that specific institution, and Annie went through that NICU, or at least not the NICU, but the PICU of that specific institution.
So NICU, neonatal, and PICU, pediatric intensive care unit?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
It's simply a biological age thing. There's very little difference other than...
And Barb, do you want to encapsulate your experience that qualifies your advocacy?
Yes. Well, the condition, my daughter Annie had the same condition as Sam's daughter Katya. And the reality is that the future is bleak for a good many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to Annie's birth, we knew that we might need to make some very difficult decisions, and we were prepared to make them.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of my daughter's death at the age of 80 days, within 24 hours arrival at the hospital, we believed, because the doctors had informed us, that she needed surgery, she wouldn't survive, and ultimately her rapid and sudden decline shortly thereafter, we believed to be of natural causes. However, obtaining the records afterwards and after thorough research, what we discovered was that the surgery that was described was by no means certain, and the coroner's office subsequently agreed with that statement.
Right.
And we also came to learn that there were multiple violations in narcotic policies, including the removal of narcotics without a doctor's order and missing records. So to this day, which is now 4 years later, we truly do not know the cause of our daughter's death, and we don't know if she could still be alive, if there was treatment that could have helped her. She was, like Sam's daughter, very mildly affected with a genetic condition. as the range of manifestations go. So that, I guess, was what launched my advocacy and research, I guess, into our healthcare system and how we treat neonates with various genetic conditions or birth defects that can be terminated before birth.
And for a listener who may be interested in future shows, I understand tomorrow you're going to a meeting to discuss this with the government.
That's right. We've been having very serious concerns with the coroner's office. The coroner made a statement that all of the narcotics were accounted for, and that a document stated that and had refused to provide the document. And since then, what we've come to learn was that we've never had a copy of the official final medication record.
Right.
And the coroner's office refuses even to answer whether they know of the final medication record or whether they have a copy of it. They refuse also to say yes or no to the question of did Annie receive the lethal quantity of narcotics that had been removed.
Right.
And is detectable in post-exhumation toxicology tests.
Just to point out how suspicious that is, because if they didn't give Annie an overdose of fentanyl or any dose of fentanyl,
the records would show.
Why wouldn't they automatically come back and say, absolutely, we didn't, there is no fentanyl involved in this?
Right.
Why haven't they, within four years, come forward with such a clear statement?
Yeah. Well, right. Where is baby Isaiah at as compared to the process for each of your children?
I'd say very early on in the advocacy. The advantage that this family has, I guess, right now, from what you see in the news, is that they have a legal case going on that is standing between a hospital agenda, you know, to remove life support,
right,
and the parents' wishes, which is to give baby Isaiah some more time before even talking about that kind of decision. And there, I can tell you one parallel. I remember when they were trying to encourage me and my wife to withdraw the prostaglandin that was keeping Katya going while we awaited the surgery,
right,
or when they tried to discourage us from pursuing the surgery over and over and over again over the months. That one of the key features was that for us was that Katya was not regressing.
Right.
So if the child is having in Katya's case especially, a relatively normal neonatal experience.
Right.
Feeding, enjoying that process.
Yeah.
And getting connected with parents and family.
Yeah.
And is not regressing.
Yeah.
And is, in fact, is developing.
Yeah.
In various measurable and observable ways. Why would you say there is a quality of life issue, even if there is something to be said of what might happen down the road? Right now, this kid is enjoying
life.
And now, I know the situation is a bit different with Isaiah James May, in that there are, you know, he's, it would appear to be in somewhat of a comatose state, but the point is he is not regressing, and in fact is making progress. And as we've learned over and over again, decades of, you know, medical interventions for people who are in that kind of a state, some of them come out of it.
Right.
In surprisingly positive ways. So why would you direct what in effect becomes a death sentence, a medical death sentence?
Right.
It just is, it's mind-boggling.
How do you see it, Barb?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Sam. You said that you compared the situation now with your early experiences with Katya, and rightfully so. I see the situation with baby Isaiah and where the family are at as a situation that we never got to, and that we regret that we never were able to have a full and complete discussion about what was wrong with our daughter, what was an accurate diagnosis, and to make best interest decisions for her in partnership with the physicians. That opportunity never existed. The doctors told us something, we believed it, and we were put in a position of having to make a very hasty decision. And as it turns out, without informed consent. So I have to some degree, I suppose, commend the scholarly staff that they are taking this through a process of sorts. And unfortunately, the process has then come to court. But that's the due process that should always exist when parents don't agree.
Right.
There should be the ability for them to obtain a lawyer, to obtain an outside expert opinion from a doctor, and for a judge then ultimately to make a decision. It's unfortunate that the matters come to that, but it's appropriate that decisions are made through a process.
I'd like to add that I don't think a family should even have to go through that. First of all, of course, it should be available if the situation calls for it. But long before that happens, there should be a dialogue and an openness of becoming informed. Under law, these kinds of decisions have to be made under the condition of informed consent. And part of being informed involves a parent seeking, other opinions if they wish, or having access to the chart. One of the things that I found really disturbing when this first hit the news is descriptions that the parents were being denied access to the chart,
right,
as much as they'd like to. Or even if they weren't being denied, discouraged. That this is entirely inappropriate in a condition where a life and death decision has to be made,
yeah,
and the parents need to be fully, duly informed, and they've chosen a route that, yeah, is then being blocked or discouraged or outright denied. I'm sorry, but in that respect, to the degree that is true, I cannot. That is sufficient for me to not commend Stollery,
right,
on the action they've taken.
Yeah. Okay.
If that's what the parent chooses,
yeah,
they want to see the chart, then
yeah,
it should be eased. It's something, the road should be paved for them. There should not be hurdles placed in the way.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, so there should be a process to enforce the availability of information for them.
I would agree with that. Even though it's supposed to be provided automatically, it is not. I know I had to fight several different times, at least two different institutions.
Mm-hmm.
I had to push and push to get access to the chart. That is not something a parent who's day and night involved in the intense medical situation of their child, they should not have to be adding to their burdens by having to fight the hospital to look at the patient chart.
No, I agree. I agree.
You would think that all of the information that was given to the parents was comprehensive and was accurate. There would be no problem sharing the chart.
Yeah, that's true too, eh?
Okay.
The written records are what you're looking for now, and you're making the same case there. If all the information that you received to date is true, why are the written records not available? And it would be the same thing with a patient's chart, right?
It's this whole, you see this pattern repeated, or this kind of flavor of entitlement and not being open, not being transparent. You see it repeated at different levels in the system. You see it at the physician level. You can see it at the hospital administrative level. You can see it at the coroner's level.
Right.
It turns out when you look at anything, it looks like the correctional ministry's level.
Yeah.
I mean, at what point do we achieve transparency? What does a parent have to go through to achieve transparency? And that reminds me, Barb, of something you were told. Finally, they did break with their avoidance. Did they not give you one statement just a couple of months ago about what the cause was of Annie's death? And when that was analyzed more carefully, we came to a quite shocking realization.
Right.
Do you want to describe that?
Right. Well, the coroner, initially, we had been told it was complications of the genetic condition trisomy 13, which is kind of, given that our daughter died in the intensive care unit, that's a pretty vague reason to cause her death, complications of a syndrome.
Right.
I mean, surely they can be more definite than that.
Yeah.
So just a few months ago, the new chief coroner came up with a redefined cause of death. He said it was due to the devastating complications of trisomy 13, so we added an adjective there.
Okay.
And then he said it was also due to central hypoventilation. Well, first of all, there can be devastating complications of trisomy 13. As Sam also well knows, but his daughter and my daughter did not suffer from those, especially
right.
a serious brain defect.
Right.
Secondly,
she's referring to holoprosencephaly.
Yeah.
To what?
That's
right.
Example.
To what?
And secondly, central hypoventilation. Well, we had to scratch our heads over that a little bit, and then after a bit of research, what we realized was that is exactly what happens when somebody dies of due to the administration of narcotics. What happens is it depresses the breathing function from the brain, and the carbon dioxide builds in the system, and the person dies.
Right.
So we immediately followed up with the chief coroner asking the question, was the central hypoventilation due to the administration of a dose of fentanyl, the missing narcotic?
Right.
And the response was, there's nothing further this office can do for you.
I see. Okay.
And do you remember, Barb, that moment, I mean, when we were talking about that, and the light bulb went on, mm-hmm. that, my goodness, this statement fits what happens with fentanyl.
Yeah, exactly.
So
primary cause. Primary risk of fentanyl use is central hypoventilation.
So it's like they want plausible, it looks like, to any thinking person who sees, you know, puts all the, lines up all the ducks of the unanswered question.
Right.
And you put them all together and you see how they relate to each other, and then you get a statement like this. What it looks like is they want plausible deniability.
All right.
They want to be able to lay, it looks like what they want to be able to say later is, yes, she was given fentanyl, or no, she wasn't, depending on what, you know, gets discovered when the whole forensic process is completed. Like, if you exhume the body, you'll know if there was fentanyl. So this statement, in the meantime, gives them an opportunity for it to be interpreted as, you know, it wasn't fentanyl, it was something else, just from the restricted airflow or whatever. Or later they could apply it in a completely different way that would admit to, you know, fentanyl use. So therefore, they can claim that they never lied about it.
Oh,
you understand what I mean?
Right.
That,
they never said, but they never lied.
Yeah, they can say, well, we never said she wasn't given fentanyl, and we gave this description, this hypoxia or whatever, I can't remember what the exact words were.
Hypoventilation.
Consistent with an overdose of fentanyl.
Right.
So why don't they just say it now? Why don't they just come out and say there was no overdose of fentanyl? Why won't they say that?
At the Stollery Hospital for baby Isaiah, has there been any comparable withdrawal of care or intervention to either reduce monitoring or increase the risk of complications of his situation?
I would sure have questions if I were in their shoes.
Oh, okay.
Only because of what you've already seen in what is, you know, patently known about the
similar cases
or the, you know, proposed disuse of it and the conditions under which that was proposed. That's a red flag. And any parent who's in the situation should view any such occurrence as a reason to dig deeper.
Right, right.
See what else might be going on. And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I would sure be duly suspicious of it.
All right.
If I was a parent in those shoes.
Yeah. Barb, and I'll ask you too, Sam, what hangs in the balance with this independent assessment we're waiting for baby Isaiah and his future?
The hospital had granted 30 days from that period. The parents were requesting 90. I don't know how you can come. This is one of the unusual things to me about this whole process is when you're attaching temporal aspects to something that should really be based upon clinical changes.
Right.
Whether a clinical development takes 1 week or 90 days or 180 days is not as important as whether the progress is happening.
Right.
An extrapolation of that improvement points in a direction that is positive. It's one thing if they're declining, but their clinical status is improving, and the medical expectations or predictions have already, on multiple measures, have already failed. So the baby's brain is not turning too much. The head size is not decreasing or staying the same. The head size is increasing. The baby's not...
What is increasing? I didn't make out that word.
The circumference of the head.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, in other words, there is an aspect of there's a component of normal neonatal experience, growth, gaining of weight.
All right.
And girth. And these things are, as I understand it, if you read what's available to the public, these things are occurring. And if the predictions from the institution and the physicians in charge of this case were opposite to what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself is a reason to put the brakes on.
Yep.
And not only put the brakes on the idea of removing the ventilator, but also put the brakes on the whole concept of applying a temporal limitation to this. It's not so much about the time, other than the money,
mm-hmm.
you know, aspects, the resource aspects. It's not so much about the time that it's taking. It's, is it going in the right direction?
Yeah. I have never read an article in the paper that says, you know, this guy's too stupid to live, you know, and the guy's, you know, alive and animate and standing in front of them, you know. I've never read that. But they seem to say that about babies all the time.
Yeah, because there's nothing imposing about them in their view. They haven't even articulated the means to, you know, sort of establish a voice for them, let alone the language.